As a final point, I want to bring up once again something which you touched on earlier, which is the fear factor. The strategy of the IRS is to make everybody frightened in the period between January and April 15th by clever PR and news items that remind people that they better pay these taxes or else something will happen. Now, this fear lingers on throughout the year. The question here is, if you've got a sort of manageable relationship going with your tax picture and your life quality is okay, do you want to just leave it alone? The thing I've heard most often from people is, don't poke the tiger. If the tiger's not chewing on your leg, just let it sleep over there in the corner. This is a very important question. I just wanted to see what you might say at this point before we close.
It's a very important question. Why don't you want to poke the tiger? Because you're afraid of the tiger if you wake it up? Doesn't that get right back to living in fear and letting fear control your life? On May 9th, 1987, a group of tax lawyers were assembled for a meeting, and the speaker was Roger M. Olson, who at the time was the Assistant Attorney General of the Tax Division, Department of Justice, Washington, D.C. He made the following statement. We encourage voluntary compliance by scaring the hell out of you. Quote, end quote. Truer words were never spoken. Another former commissioner of the IRS said it's ironic that the citizen who stands on their constitution fares far better than the one who voluntarily furnishes information. You see, there is the dichotomy. Yeah, I've had people say, well, you know, I got the house, I got the boat, I got the cottage at the lake, I got the wave runners, you know, I got the two kids in college, I got the three cars. I got too much to lose to rock the boat. We never tell anybody that they should file or not file. That's not our position. We make our research available so that people can make informed decisions relative to themselves with the legal documentation to back up their decision, whichever way they decide to go. For me, it became a moral issue. When I found out it was a Virgin Islands only form, for me to sign it and say I live in the Virgin Islands was a lie. That was perjury. The perjury statement itself, there are two perjury statements for contracts in America. One is for within the United States, Washington, D.C., and the territories within the corporate United States, and one is for within the 50 states. And the one that's on the bottom of that 1040 form is actually a perjury statement for someone who is under an oath of office to perform. And the definition even of trade or business within the tax code. If you go to the back to 7701 definition section, I thought a trade was an electrician or a carpenter or like my dad was, a watchmaker. I found under the tax code the only definition for a trade or business is the performance of the functions of a public office. And I'll leave you with one to ponder and study. If you go back to the sources of taxable income, you'll find a non-resident alien effectively connected with a trade or business within the United States. So if you put that into the defined terms, a non-resident alien performing the functions of a public office within Washington, D.C. or the territories is a taxable income. But how can a non-resident alien perform the functions of a public office? Our Constitution says that you must be 25 years old and a citizen of the 50 states for a minimum of 7 years to be able to be allowed to run as a representative. You must be 30 years old and a citizen for 9 years to be able to run for the Senate. So you have to be an American or a United States citizen granted your citizenship under the 14th Amendment with terms of residency before you can perform the functions of a public office. So who is this non-resident alien who can do that? Is it maybe the person who is non-resident to Washington, D.C. and the territories? And an alien to the citizenship of federality? Could it be you? Could it be me? The non-resident alien being the American citizens that reside in the 50 states who can become taxable by being elected to public office in Washington, D.C. and becoming federal employees or entering into an employment agreement with the U.S. government or becoming involved in an excisable revenue activity such as alcohol, tobacco, and firearms that we have delegated the authority to the government to oversee. And other than that, under the Title 26 code, are not subject to any tax under Subtitle A and not required to have any identifying numbers. And under Code of Federal Regulations, a non-resident alien never makes self-employment income because such non-resident alien individual will not be subject to self-employment since any net earnings which he may have from self-employment do not constitute self-employment income. Don't you love these definitions that dance around themselves and say nothing really?
I'm totally confused.
Exactly, and that's exactly what they want you to be. What American citizen would jump up and say, I'm a non-resident alien? But you know what? Only under the Title 26 code. Now, I'm not going to get into that. That's going to leave people with a lot of questions, and they're either going to love me or hate me, but I'm going to say, do your due diligence. Come to one of the seminars. Come to one of the events. Come to Q2, where you can see this for yourself and meet the people, see the research, meet the federal lawyers, and realize this is the truth, and it's been working very well for over 17 years for the people who have chosen to practice and put this research to use. And I'm going to leave you with one other mind blower. And this one makes people think I'm totally out in left field, but that's fine. If they do their due diligence, they'll find I'm right. Under Section 7805 of the Title 26 Code, it says that the Secretary of the Treasury, or his delegate, shall promulgate all the rules and regulations necessary for the enforcement and collection of the tax. You go searching the code trying to find the definition of who this Secretary of the Treasury is. They want you to assume it's the Secretary of the Treasury of the United States of America. You will find the definition in 27 Code of Federal Regulations, Section 26.11. They move it every few months. 3 months ago, it was under 250.11. Now it's 26.11. And by the time this CD comes out, it might be moved again. But who is that secretary? It specifically states the Secretary of the Department of the Treasury of Puerto Rico. And the delegate, same thing. Now, can I back that up? In 1998, the United States Court of Appeals for the First Circuit identified a second Secretary of the Treasury as a man by the name of Manuel Diaz Saldana. Definitions of secretary and secretary or his delegate at 27 CFR 26.11 and the published decision in Used Tire International Incorporated versus Manuel Diaz Saldana, court docket number 97-2348, September 11th, 1998. Both definitions mention Puerto Rico. Now, Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands can have representatives in Congress, but they cannot vote on anything pertaining to the 50 states. So how can the Secretary of the Treasury of Puerto Rico be the one to promulgate the rules and regulations for the collection of the tax on my labor as an American? It gets pretty scary when you think about it. But the research is there, it's out there, and I'm just going to leave people with this. If you want to build a substantive administrative defense in your personal files at IRS, if you want to remove that presumption of liability that has been placed there either erroneously or fraudulently, then get your files decoded. Rebut it properly. Then they have no more power over you. The biggest thing they're afraid of are intelligent, informed Americans who know the law and have studied the law and are no longer in fear. Without fear, they lose all their clout. Do they commit fraud? Each and every day. The intentional perversion of truth for the purpose of inducing another in reliance to part with some valuable thing or surrender a legal right. A false representation of a matter of fact, whether by words or by conduct, by false or misleading allegations, or by concealment of that which should have been disclosed, which deceives and is intended to deceive another, so that he shall act upon it to his legal injury. Anything calculated to deceive, whether by a single act or combination, by suppression of truth, or suggestion of what is false, whether it be by direct falsehood or innuendo, by speech or silence, word of mouth or look or gesture. Under the IRS's own Internal Revenue Manual, Chapter 3, it says, under taxpayer correspondence, all correspondence received from taxpayers must be answered, and the answer should indicate this is in reply to your correspondence of such and such a date, etc. How many people out there? We just saw a case where someone was exonerated in an evasion case for almost $1 million because the IRS had never answered their letters over years asking, where is the law that says I have to file a return and pay a tax on my labor? Just show me a copy of the law, and I'll be happy to pay any tax I legally owe. And those letters went unanswered in violation. That's a due process violation. In U.S. v. Tweel, U.S. v. Pruden, and Carmine v. Bowen, the court ruled silence can be equated with fraud where there is a legal or moral duty to speak or where an inquiry left unanswered would be intentionally misleading. We cannot condone this shocking behavior by the IRS. Our revenue system is based on the good faith of the taxpayer, and the taxpayer should be able to expect the same from the government in its enforcement and collection activities. Unfortunately, we cannot expect truth from government. I think we've seen that since the assassination of JFK and the questions that have remained left unanswered in many, many other events, up to and including current events, where there are blatant, glaring questions of credibility that are ignored, stonewalled, left in silence, which is fraud on the part of our government towards its people.